Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable. But first, joining us today to update us on the presidential transition are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who is now the chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and the chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Both of these gentlemen have been associated with, in some fashion or other, in the defense side of every presidential transition over the past four decades. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago.
Good to be here.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. General Motors Defense is sponsoring our coverage of technology. And Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. We are now getting more and more nominees, which is certainly very good news. Christine Wormuth, former Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the Obama administration, named for Army Secretary, sending a historic candidate there, first woman to occupy the job, should she be confirmed as expected by the Senate. Ron Moultrie, veteran national security official, National Security Agency, was Chief of Signals Intelligence. Michael was your partner on the cyber report for the Navy that was a needle mover. We've got a number of other folks. Michael, start us off, right? I mean, where are we on this whole process? Arnold, I want to come to you on the legislative side of things, but Michael, you're the calendar keeper. We've also got a bunch of folks that were named at the State Department at ambassadorial ranks, but Colin Kahl and his confirmation appear to be slowing down some of these jobs as well. Why don't you start us off on the who's who and their qualifications for the jobs that they're going into?
Well, thanks, Vago. You know, obviously, we're 3 months into the Biden administration, and we now have, as you said, three more nominees, Susanna Blum, Gil Cisneros, and Christine Wormuth. That takes us to 9 of the 61 total DOD appointees. Clearly, this Biden team is not working off of a preconceived list of people. They are taking their time. They are in real time recruiting for these jobs. So it's not going to be as fast, I think, as many of us thought it would be, but they are bringing in a lot of talent to the job. Sadly, they haven't released the names of the other two service leaders. These are the really big jobs. They run the military departments, their key positions. They're where most of the department's people and the contractors are. They're where the businesses of the department is done. And of course, where much of the money's spent. The challenge for every administration is to find enterprise committed people, particularly the service secretaries, who are enterprise committed, not institutionalists. That is, secretaries who embody the conviction that they are the president's person running, say, the Army, not the Army's person there to protect the Army from the SecDef, the President of the Congress. Past secretaries like Richard Spencer or Fran Harvey forgot that, and they were fired. So these, for all of these jobs, for the Biden's administration's policy goals, they're only real when they're backed up by real good people and budget. And for the Biden national security policy ambitions, these first 9 jobs are very crucial jobs. So let me turn it over to Arnold, and then we can roll through some of these others.
Well, Vago, I think Michael has outlined well that we have superbly qualified names. But as you well know, and as Michael well knows, the confirmation process is paper driven. And of the 6 new names that we have, actually only 3 are pending in the Senate. The Mike McCord to be comptroller, Mike Brown to be the under for A&S, and Ron Moultrie to be the under for intelligence and security. The other 3 are intense to nominate, and the Senate doesn't start till the nominations are actually received in the Senate. Then you have to get all the paperwork done, both on the executive branch side and the legislative branch side. And the committee rules require that you can't have a confirmation hearing at least for 2 weeks once the nomination is actually in the Senate, because they have to get time to gear it up. So if you look at the clock between now and Memorial Day, it's going to be very challenging, even though, as Michael outlined, these are very highly qualified, highly respected individuals, and they are going to get a thorough but very favorable review by the Senate Armed Services Committee in the U.S. Senate. But I think it's going to be a tall order to get all six of them confirmed by the Memorial Day recess. And by the way, the Congress is out for a week, the first week in May. And furthermore, you've got the issue of the Senate floor, where the minority now is requiring cloture on a lot of votes. And you have, as Michael has indicated, the Colin Kahl nomination, which still has not been discharged from the Armed Services Committee. And if it gets to the Senate floor and they agree to discharge it, which will be a floor vote with 4 hours equally divided, then he's going to have another couple of votes on the actual nomination. So the calendar right now is very time-consuming in terms of getting these six very qualified, very needed individuals confirmed and appointed in the Department of Defense by Memorial Day recess. Over.
Let me just add on to something that Arnold said about the importance of these jobs. The Biden administration appears to have chosen to nominate these in an order of internal priority that's relevant to them. And two of these jobs, CAPE and PNR, less known to the rest of the world, are really important. And the fact that they're announcing them early in the lineup enhances their priority and importance. CAPE is the line judge. They're the referee in the department's resource scrums. And it works best when the director, now for the first time to be an assistant secretary, is personally close to the secretary and the deputy. Susanna is a real find for the administration. She has that longstanding personal relationship with the deputy, Kath Hicks. And over the past 4 months of transition and administration, she's built the same with Secretary Austin. Arnold and I have had the great pleasure to work with her and observe her mind at work over the years. And she and Mike McCord are going to be a pretty powerful team. And they're going to be in place, as Arnold says, likely well in time to build the department's first real budget, the FY23. PNR, which is oftentimes the sleeper job of the department, Arnold and I have said for years, this is where the must spend money is. It's where well better than half of the DOD budget that is spent on people and people-related expenditures. Only after those accounts are satisfied does the SecDef get to spend the rest of his budget. So in my mind, it's really one of the most important, if not the third most important job in the building. And yet most outsiders have never heard much about it. Under this administration's policy ambition, they'll also be driving a host of social issues and imposing new or additional costs on the services in the Fourth Estate. Gil Cisneros, when he's confirmed, is going to be a very busy guy. Over.
I don't know if they're going to be there in time. Well, they'll be there in time for FY23, but
23.
That's going to have to step down as CAPE director, because under the Vacancy Act, she's not qualified to be the first assistant. So once her nomination is actually pending in the Senate, she will no longer be able to be performing the duties of CAPE. I find their nominations to come, I don't think they're early on. These are two that typically they do right at the outset. So I don't find that to be a deviation from previous administration priorities. Over.
Michael, you make a great point. Arnold, I understand what you're saying, but Michael, you make a great point. Suzanne has been studying this stuff for a very long time, very focused on change. And then you're absolutely right, Mike McCord. There's a reason these folks are coming into the jobs they are. And you're absolutely right. Cisneros is going to be somebody who's going to be very busy. How serious, Arnold, is the trouble that Colin Kahl is in? Because this goes a little bit beyond whether or not people didn't like his tweets.
Well, the current issue is a sizable number of Republican senators have written to the director of the FBI, Chris Wray, and asked for an investigation into whether or not Colin Kahl either intentionally or inadvertently disclosed classified information. I don't know the facts of the issue, and it really depends on whether or not the FBI decides they're willing to do such an investigation. The ranking member of the Armed Services Committee, Chairman Inhofe, has asked that any consideration on the Senate floor be delayed until this issue can be sorted out. So it's a serious allegation. Whether it has merit or not, I mean, that's going to have to be decided by our law enforcement and investigatory personnel. But it certainly is a development that will continue to slow down the ability of the Senate, again, to consider his nomination, which was a tie vote in the Senate Armed Services Committee, 13-13. Therefore, it can't be reported to the Senate unless a motion to discharge is passed on the Senate floor, and then they could get to the nomination. The nomination has been in the pipeline for a long, long time. That is never a good sign in the nomination process. That said, you know, he could be totally innocent of these allegations and deserves to be considered in the Senate, up or down. Over.
But once you introduce this, it effectively, the clock is stopped until you have a ruling from the FBI, correct? So this could take weeks or months.
His situation is he stalled out in a holding pattern in the Senate Armed Services Committee until the FBI decides one way or the other. And if they don't decide to investigate, that'll be used on the floor as, you know, the administration is covering up and not willing to basically get the facts out on the table. Again, he could be totally innocent. And a lot of people have suggested that is the case, that there's nothing there. But again, it's a pretty serious thing when more than a dozen senators write the head of the FBI and ask for an investigation.
In the modern political environment, I'm not sure I agree with you, Arnold. I think in the modern political environment, I think it's a lot easier for 12 senators who are very eager at tanking somebody's nomination to write a letter saying, let's.
With the greatest respect, that might be the case for domestic nominations. It's never been the case for DOD nominations that have always been handled. And in the Senate Armed Services Committee, this is an extremely rare situation where you have a partisan vote on a DOD nominee. So I just fundamentally disagree with you.
Everything is the same, Arnold, until it's not, right? It's nonpartisan until it starts becoming partisan. Michael, give us your last thought and your State Department point as well. Go ahead.
Well, Vago, one more thing. It is always the same until it's different. And one thing that this nomination has done is cause a lot of people who've been very active on social media who were considering appointments in the administration to reconsider the personal risk that they may be undertaking by putting their name forward. The challenge we've had over the last couple of decades is a series of cases, each of which have added to the deterrent effect of qualified people serving in the world's largest enterprise. So I think the tragedy of this is just one more set of hurdles. Last point, you mentioned it, Arnold mentioned it as well. We saw a large tranche of nominees come out of the State Department the other day. And the last time we were together, we were commenting about how DOD was ahead of state in this rush to get all of its people appointed. State has clearly come online and has a large quantity of people online. So much to watch. And I think in the coming weeks and months, we're going to see a lot more people come up. As I said in the very beginning, we've only got 9 of the 61 slots named. So there's a lot more fleshing out of this department to be observed and commented on. Over.
Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you guys on, and look forward to having you guys on again soon. Thanks a lot. And have a great weekend and a good week.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Vago.
And joining us now for our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond are Lisa Curtis of the Center for a New American Security, who served on the National Security Council, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many roles is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be back.
Thank you.
Thanks, Vago.
Always a pleasure having you guys back on. Michael, and we've got a lot to talk about today, obviously, from the infrastructure measure, Congress being back in session, reaction to the skinny budget, obviously reaction to the president's decision to withdraw all U.S. Combat forces from Afghanistan by 9/11 on the 20th anniversary of the attack on the United States by Al-Qaeda. and then also get a little bit of a sense on the sanctions that the administration has imposed on Russia as Russia continues its saber rattling and response to meddling in everything from U.S. elections to broader American life. Michael, why don't you start us off? Congress is obviously back. Members are looking at infrastructure, responding to the skinny budget, and obviously to Afghanistan and even the Russia sanctions. Give us a sense. Let's start with infrastructure, right? Closely divided, 50-50. Joe Manchin and just about any Democrat on the Senate is now a power in their own right on this $2.2 trillion measure. Where do we stand, and what are, right, as more people think about what the implications are for defense, what are the implications for defense and for national security and its most classical connotation?
Sure. So you're right. It is a 50-50 Senate, and you know, each senator, especially on the Democratic side, does have tremendous clout. But remember, too, the House right now, you know, there are many special elections to fill, but when they are filled, it's anticipated that Pelosi only has a 5-seat majority. So she can only afford to lose 4 votes. So the margins are tight in both chambers. And I mentioned 2 weeks ago that Senator Schumer was trying to use a provision of the Congressional Budget Act of 1974 to unlock future reconciliation packages. Instead of being able to use the FY21, FY22 package, he wanted the ability to amend them. And the parliamentarian agreed with him. So actually has 3 more bites at the apple with reconciliation if they can use them. So, you know, but right now they're trying to, as of today, go on a 2-pronged approach for infrastructure. So it's a big change from where they were initially, because they are trying to do this on a bipartisan basis. And the Republicans are talking to the Democrats about a possible $600 to $800 billion number. That's a big number. Now, it's less than the $1.7 trillion that Biden initially floated, but this would be purely looking at what people can agree is infrastructure, roads, bridges, highways, wastewater, drinking water, things like that. It would be unlikely to include the defense implications that we talked about, the $180 billion for R&D investment, which would have big implications for defense. But if they are able to get this accomplished, then what they would want to do is then roll everything up into a second bill and pass it by reconciliation. But that's also making some of the Republicans balk, saying, hey, look, we're not going to work with you to get this done, only to have you jam everything down our throat later on in the second bill. So while things are progressing, there is a very, very long way to go on infrastructure. As far as the skinny budget is concerned, you know, look, it was met with, you know, not unexpected derision by, you know, I think House Republicans, you know, claiming it was too low. You know, looking at how much money the Biden administration is adding on to the debt with, you know, coronavirus relief packages, infrastructure on top of what the Trump administration already did, and looking at the increases for non-defense domestic discretionary. And if you look at the defense numbers, as well as the Homeland Security numbers, not adjusted for inflation, they're technically a cut. However, it is, you know, behind the scenes, the numbers are, you know, what we expected, if not, you know, probably a little better than expected. But, you know, Republicans have come out not only some strong statements, but also, you know, reminding Democrats of their own statements. I mean, Secretary Austin testified before Armed Services Committee earlier this year about China closing the gap with the United States. Kat Hicks, you know, when she was a commissioner on the National Defense Strategy Commission, approved a 3-5% increase every year in the defense budget above inflation. So, you know, there's a lot of concern among the Republicans that these numbers will impact readiness. Will impact, you know, modernization, the ability to project naval power across the world. They'll impact innovation. And at the same time, you know, it's getting some, I wouldn't say the numbers are, but the budget itself is getting some harsh treatment from some of the Democrats. I mean, House Armed Services Chairman Adam Smith, in a statement the other day, you know, was quoted as saying, you know, he's concerned that the Biden administration is dragging their feet, getting the budget to them. You know, they need to get moving. He's saying they aren't going to have time to do their job, and we're definitely headed for a continuing resolution, you know, at the end of this year. So, you know, I think the bigger concern here is not to get wrapped up in the number, but what's in the number. I mean, the defense community wanted to make sure that this bill gets passed. And I talked to 2 senior members yesterday on the Republican side, one on appropriations, one on armed services, you know, that we're really talking about what's in it. And they said, you know, the money that's in this for the transgender stuff and the green stuff, that doesn't count. So they don't want to hear about the energy initiatives and the global climate change. You know, there's going to be a big battle as to how this top line money is spent. And Democrats know they cannot pass a bill without Republican support. So there's some big battles ahead.
But I think one of the interesting elements of this is that in private, when I've talked to people, they say $753 billion is a lot of money right, Adam Smith is publicly on that, but even Republican friends of mine tell me the same thing. And the question is the choices that we make within it, right? I mean, at this point, nobody wants to jeopardize any legacy program. And so everybody's sort of like on guard to defend their particular congressional interest, seeing as how we have an illustrious former comptroller on our panel. Dove, you know, it's been a week. You know, do you think any differently? And what's the feedback that you're receiving at the end of the day from members?
Well, first of all, Adam Smith was speaking at the Reagan Institute, and he talked about just what you just said. He said, everybody wants to modernize the military, but not at the expense of the legacy programs in their districts. So, you know,
I would commend to the audience to listen to that great conversation that just happened to have been moderated by your dashing and intelligent son, Roger Zakon.
What can I say? the thing that really interests me is what we're not hearing. And that is that even from the more pro-defense Democrats, we're not really hearing a big outcry. And I think part of it, and I was on the Hill this week, is that they're looking at ways to literally make the department more efficient, how to get through that so-called valley of death, for instance. Maybe even fiddle around with some of the things that I've suggested in the past, which is to make the movement of money from one account to another much easier without going and saying, Mother, may I, to four committees. I mean, there seems to be a feeling that, as you said, the 700 and whatever, however many more billion is something to work with if you can work with it properly. And the truth of the matter is between Congress, which is still a 1950s institution, and the Pentagon, which is still operating the way McNamara operated it, there's a lot of room for improvement. And with $700 billion to play with, if you could improve, maybe, you might not make it all the way to where 3-5% would have you go, but you certainly would do better than we're likely to do better right now.
I want to move on to the Afghanistan discussion now, Dove, and so you get a second bite immediately at the apple. You were obviously at the Pentagon on 9/11. You were, I should say, right? I mean, you were on the team on 9/11. I think you were on travel that day, but were part of the decision making to move forward with military operations in Afghanistan. Is the president's decision at this point, 20 years after that war, given how things, the start of that war, given how things have going, is this the right decision or the wrong decision?
Well, I came back on the 12th to hear President Bush speak at the Pentagon, and it was clear to me at that meeting, which took place at 6 o'clock that evening, that we were going to go to war. And I think it was the right thing to do then. I think now it was the right thing to do. Look, whether or not you think Biden is right, the fact of the matter is he's made the decision. And in my view, the real question is, okay, now what? Because I don't think we have thought through the second and third order consequences of that decision. The Afghan National Army cannot hold out on its own. They're going to lose. And I'm convinced that Kabul will fall the way Saigon fell. And you're going to have a humanitarian disaster. That's what I've written about in today's The Hill, because these refugees are not going to be going back to Pakistan. They'll have nowhere to go. And so one possibility is to create a kind of Kurdistan in the north of Afghanistan, because there will be a civil war again. There will be a northern alliance of Tajiks and Uzbeks again. And this time, maybe instead of doing it clandestinely with the agency, we do it openly. We provide them arms, we provide them economic assistance, we provide them humanitarian assistance, and we create a Kurdistan. And let me tell you, if Saddam Hussein, who was a heck of a lot stronger than the Taliban, could not beat the Peshmerga in Kurdistan, these Taliban characters are not going to beat the Northern Alliance if we are openly helping them. But this has to be thought through. I personally would not have made this decision. I don't think we have all that many troops there to begin with, but enough to keep the place at least somehow ticking over. So no, I would not have made that decision, but the decision's been made. And now we have to seriously think about, okay, what do we do? Because if Afghanistan becomes the way it was in the 90s, we're going to have a new Al-Qaeda or somebody else there. And the argument that, well, we've got terrorists elsewhere. If you had seen the terrorist bases, which I did see when I was in Afghanistan, they were huge. They were like cities. And we just don't want that to happen again. And we better think long and hard as to how we prevent it.
And obviously, right, I mean, a big part of the concern is just like the 2013 withdrawal from Afghanistan, that the situation will get worse and then you have to go back in and it becomes very, very difficult and complicated. And then there's the issue of leaving an ally in a lurch the way we're doing now. Although I will point out, I think everybody who remembers the late, great Arno de Borgrav, Arno made a very, very similar prediction to this many, many years ago, which is this is going to end like Vietnam did. The corruption, the cost of the war will get to the point where the Congress will say, all right, look, enough's enough. Although this time it's a little bit different. Congress is not necessarily pulling the plug. Lisa, you were in the Trump administration where you wrestled with this issue. Obviously, the president wanted to withdraw U.S. forces. That precipitated, I think, a fulsome debate in the administration that ended up leading to the resignation of the defense secretary. At the end of the day, and you were on the program about a month ago saying, look, a residual presence of about $5 billion a year is the right approach. What do you think of the decision now that it's been made? What do you think of the decision? And now that it's been made, what can happen to best mitigate the potential consequences?
Well, I think it was the wrong decision. And I just want to say, I agree with everything that Dov Zakheim said. And I think his idea about Kurdistan-like Northern Afghanistan is quite interesting. I don't think it's something we need to jump into, but it's something that we should consider if the situation deteriorates quickly and very badly. I think that's a very intriguing idea that we should give further consideration. But, you know, I do think that it was inadvisable and unnecessary to fully withdraw US forces. I advised against this when I was in the Trump administration, and I would have advised President Biden against it now. It risked the Taliban returning to power, reversing human rights and civil society gains. And most importantly, it risked the reemergence of a dangerous terrorist safe haven. Look, this decision is likely to inspire extremists across the globe. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda will push this victory narrative that they were able to eject not only U.S. forces, but 40 NATO countries from the country. So I think it's very possible that we do see this reconvergence of international right. terrorists on Afghanistan the same way we saw in the 1990s. And it really is reminiscent of ISIS rise in Iraq in 2014, 3 years after the US decided to remove forces there. Now in Afghanistan's case, the situation is likely to deteriorate even more quickly than in Iraq. So it's a very dangerous situation. And now that the U.S. has forfeited its strongest point of leverage in the peace talks, which is its troop presence, I think it's very unlikely the Taliban is going to pursue a peace process. And so we should really shift our attention to figuring out, you know, how we're going to offshore our counterterrorism capabilities and how we're going to continue to fund the Afghan security forces who we've been partnering with for the last 20 years. And whose help has helped us get at the Al-Qaeda targets that are still in Afghanistan.
Right.
So I think Dov is right. He's made the decision. Now we have to figure out how we're going to protect our interests in Afghanistan. The decision has made it more difficult, but we still need to do everything we can to guard against this possibility of the reemergence of a terrorist safe haven.
I one question I want to ask you, Lisa, and Michael, I want to get to your congressional reaction here in a moment. How is China going to exploit this? Because I think that the United States has a tendency of failing to understand that any place we leave a vacuum, the Russians and the Chinese are more than happy to fill it and have been advancing their relationship, for example, all across the Middle East and the Gulf. I was in the Emirates, in the before times when you could travel, and there were a whole series of major initiatives that were actually not aimed at the United States, but actually were were aimed at getting Chinese capital and investment and deepening the relationship with Beijing. What's the role China's likely to play on this? And will they be actually standing, you know, in Kabul waving goodbye to us as we leave?
Well, look, I think the Chinese have complicated interests in Afghanistan as well. They don't want to see the rise of international terrorism. They're worried about it spilling into Xinjiang province. So I think they have sort of a mixed goal here. They will try to have good relations with the Taliban, you know, just like they did in the 1990s. They tried to work with the Taliban to mitigate the threats from, you know, Uyghurs that might have been mixed in with the terrorist groups there. So, you know, they will try to mitigate the risk against themselves, but they'll probably use their good relationship with Pakistan to access the Taliban and try to, you know, build a common approach with the Taliban. But, you know, they are not necessarily thrilled with the idea of the Taliban rising to power in Afghanistan either. I think they really would prefer a more stable country where they could, you know, exploit the natural resources there and, you know, have their Belt and Road projects be more successful. So I don't necessarily think that China is thrilled with the idea of increased instability. And I think they recognize that U.S. troops being there had helped to a certain degree. So I think it's a mixed picture.
But it is right. It is another opportunity for China to fill a void. And I should have pointed out that right, NATO has made the decision that it's going to, you know, that members are going to withdraw their forces by May 1. Right. I mean, so at the end of the day, a little bit of we all came in together, we're all leaving together is unfortunately the message. I mean, the question is what happens to 13,000 or so contractors that are in the country that support this troop presence. Dov, why don't you give us a quick word on this? Because I know that you've thought about what a Chinese role in that area. And obviously, right, I mean, the United States doesn't necessarily have to do things just because the Chinese do them. As a retired military friend of mine said, you know, if the Chinese want to get in Afghanistan, God bless them, it won't be any easier for them than it was for us. But go ahead.
Well, the Chinese might do it very, very differently. There's a report coming out of Hong Kong's South China Morning Post that's saying that they're considering sending a peacekeeping force if the security situation deteriorates. Now, that's a very, very different kind of approach. It's very clever because peacekeeping won't alienate anybody, but it gets the Chinese in. So I think Lisa's right. China's not going to, they don't want to work to support the Taliban, but they're going to live with them as they did before. And this will give them a way to fill an American vacuum and do so in a way that doesn't alienate anybody. They're peacekeepers. I put that in quotation marks, but that's what they'll call them. And lo and behold, the United States has betrayed an ally, and who comes to bail them out? The Chinese.
Michael, how are lawmakers responding to this plan? What are the new rifts and fissures? I mean, the New York Times wrote a piece that this is showing fractures even within the GOP, right? How are the members you're talking to responding to this?
Sure. So actually, I was up on the Hill for the first time in 13 months this week. So got to talk to some staff as well as some members. And like, you know, I think what a lot of people say privately is a little different than what they say publicly. This as far as how vocal they are, because I think we see some vocal response and we see some muted response. And your point's well taken. I mean, I think obviously the decision receives, you know, praise from progressives. And it's not well received from a lot of GOP hawks, but there's some splits. So you've got folks like Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, obviously Mike Rogers, Senator Inhofe, you know, on the side explaining why they think this was a bad decision. On the other side, you have progressives like Elizabeth Warren, but you know, joined by moderate Democrats like Jean Shaheen and Tim Kaine, and then Republicans like, you know, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. Because remember, you know, it was Trump that wanted to be the guy to end these forever wars. So you've got a lot of people still singing that tune. And I talked to some congressional staff about that yesterday. But, you know, I think that, you know, first, we've seen some strong statements come out from, for example, from Mike Rogers, you know, reminding folks that Al-Qaeda has been operating in Afghanistan as recently as March, that this sends the wrong signal to our adversaries like China, Russia, and Iran. He then actually put out a joint statement with Senator Inhofe, urging him to reconsider his decision. And then, you know, you got some Democrats that are being very careful how they word things. I mean, even Senator Jack Reed, who chairs the Senate Armed Services Committee, you know, said that Biden's making a tough call on what may be the least of any bad options. He's not saying it is. He's saying it might be. And Alyssa Slotkin, you know, asking some tough questions. I mean, what's the security architecture going to look like to ensure that the terrorists don't reconstitute? And then what's the diplomatic plan, you know, over there? So that's, I think, their way of criticizing the decision without criticizing it. And then I think, you know, there's some frustration, too, that the media is really giving Biden a pass on this and kind of praising him for going against the military brass and against even testimony from his own CIA director recently that contradicts, you know, this decision and making it seem like it's so rare when somebody does that. Well, you know, Trump did the same thing, too, in Syria. And that didn't work out so well for us and for our you know, our Kurdish allies over there.
Well, I mean, right. I mean, we've talked about this. All hell broke loose when President Trump said he was going to do this. And now there's this sort of sense of right, courageous decision. It's important for us to wrap it up. You know, you may be tired of the war. The war may not be tired of you at the end of the day. Right. And so you
exactly
you need to be engaged in that as well. You know, I'd like to move on to Russia in a minute, but Lisa, I'm going to give you the last word on this. Go ahead.
Well, just following up on something Michael just said, you know, we're not ending the war. Everybody keeps saying, you know, we're ending the endless war. We're ending our involvement. The war is going to continue. The war is going to worsen. And we still have key national security interests there. So, you know, it was President Biden's prerogative about pulling out U.S. troops. But let's be clear that the war is not ending and the U.S. still has critical national security interest in preventing the reemergence of a terrorist safe haven in Afghanistan. He's taken a risky decision. I personally think it was the wrong decision. And I think that there will be some regrets maybe as early as a year from now. And there is probably even the possibility that the U.S. would have to send back in U.S. forces just as it did in Iraq in 2014.
Hopefully that's not what happens, but we'll certainly be paying attention to that. And of course, I should have mentioned, Michael, as you were talking, right, Alyssa Slotkin was a CIA officer and she was engaged in Afghanistan strategy. So she's somebody who does have a lot of depth on that issue. We've got a couple of minutes left. Dov, I wanted to go to you and get your sense on the administration's Russia sanctions. Seen more, Michael, maybe get your sense on this as well. Right, seen more as a warning. We haven't, you know, we did stuff on debt. Not that the Russians buy a lot of debt, right? But certainly some warning that we may use the financial clout that we have over the Russians to make this painful. At the end of the day, did we do enough to punish Russia, which has basically still not been punished for 2016 or a number of other transgressions? Right? I mean, we did a whole bunch of Ukraine sanctions, but we didn't keep trimming them. So, like any sanctions, people get used to them. At the end of the day, is this the right response to Russia, especially in the wake of solar winds and everything else we've seen?
Well, the president, Biden, said that this was proportionate. I don't know that it was proportionate. I mean, we're putting sanctions on entities that don't really do much business here or individuals that don't have too much money here. Yes, we're preventing, we're affecting to some extent their business with American banks, but secondary business has not been blocked. So what we've essentially done is it's not exactly a slap on the wrist that the previous administration imposed. It's a harder slap on the wrist. Let me put it that way. The wrist might look a little bit red. But if I were President Putin, I would say I can keep going, at least for a while. I can continue to test the United States. So far, I've gotten away with it, and their reaction has not been all that strong. And oh, by the way, we don't know how Putin interpreted the Biden request for a summit. We know he turned it down, but did he see it as a request because of Biden's weakness or Biden's strength? We don't know that. And if he saw it as a request because of Biden's weakness, and then he saw the nature of what Biden has just imposed. I don't know that he will be prevented from continuing to do what he's doing on Ukraine's borders.
Michael, let's bring it home for us, if you would. How are lawmakers responding to this? Do they think that this is a tough response, or is this, as Dove said, sort of another slap on the wrist as opposed to a kick in the butt, which is what might be necessary here?
I think it's more in line with what Dove said. I haven't talked to a single lawmaker or a single staffer who thinks this is tough enough. I mean, and several astute observers have pointed out to me that, you know, the previous sanctions, haven't stopped them from the bloodshed in Syria, haven't kicked them out of Crimea, haven't stopped them from massing troops at the Ukrainian border. It didn't stop the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and his subsequent imprisonment, didn't prevent them from interfering in our elections again, in 2020. So right now, this is just a big yawn, coupled with, the concerns about not only withdrawing from Afghanistan, but the budget sending the wrong signals to Russia that we're not taking their threats seriously.
30 seconds, if I may, 30 seconds more. Iran, United States, Israel's attack on Natanz. Anything more you'd like to add to that, Dove, in terms of what it tells us, in terms of what's next with Iran?
Well, Netanyahu is still trying to form a government. He's used the Iran bogeyman over and over again to scare the Israeli public. After all, they're terrified of another Holocaust, and he plays on that. It's not so much the attack, but the timing of the attack that is so interesting to me.
And why is it so interesting to you?
Because it strengthens Netanyahu's hand with both the Israeli public and the people he's trying to get into his government, because he says, look, we've got a new crisis, and I'm the man that can stand up to Iran and the United States and keep us safe, as I've done for the last 10 years.
Everybody, thanks so very much for joining us. Lisa, it was a pleasure having you on the program. Look forward to welcoming you back again in the future. Hope you guys all have a great weekend, a great week, and talk to you again next week. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot, Vago. It's been great.
Thank you, Vago.
Thanks, Vago, as always.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.